You have an amendment, an author's amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. It's the A3 amendment.
All right. Chair will move the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Morgan, your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the speed and the dispatch. House Bill 1866, Mr. Chair and committee members, is an unsessioned bill. We are taking a look at a few particular areas of the Commerce Department, some advisory committees that appear not to have met in pretty much as long as anyone could remember. They are mostly dealing with areas of energy, and the bill passed out of Energy Committee last week. The amendment that we just added on is a clarification of continued existence of the Automobile Theft Prevention Advisory Board, which I think clarification of continued existence ought to be something we all get every now and then. A simple bill, and I'd appreciate the committee's support. The Commerce Committee did testify in support of the bill. Commerce Department did testify in support of the bill in energy. I don't know if they are here right now. I'm imagining they're somewhere. But
I believe they're here.
Yeah.
And given a thumbs up. Representative Morgan, are you aware of any opposition to the bill?
I am not aware of any opposition to this bill, Mr.
Chair. And have you contacted all of the former members of these advisory groups and commissions to elicit their input? And
we're having a party Friday night, Mr. Chair.
Right. Are there questions for Representative Morgan? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, on the Auto Theft Prevention Board, can you tell me that all the funds that are collected from people's independent car insurance, are all those funds being used by the Auto Theft Prevention Board, or have they been diverted to the general fund?
To the extent you know, Representative Morgan?
I need to phone a friend, Mr. Chair. I don't know the answer to that question.
I believe we have people in the room that may have that answer for you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brickwitty, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes or no?
You can't get that out of him.
Yeah.
Let's find out.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. Yes. The only thing that I would add is that we had the largest amount of dollars out of the fund to grant recipients in the last biennium in the history of the program.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Morgan, I'm happy to work with you in making sure that we reduce the fund and the fee to individual car insurance folks, the insurance that you pay, so that the fund is actually truly reflective of what the needs are for the prevention board. So happy to work with you offline to reduce that so that we're not driving up the cost of car insurance for citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson, happy to hear more about that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Morgan. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 1866? If not, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 1866 be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Next up is House File 917, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You got members. A twofer. House File 917, Representative Schoen will move that House File 917 be referred to the General Register. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To make this really quick, right now you can tamper with a snowmobile odometer, and it is perfectly legal. We are amending statute to add the snowmobile to the appropriate sections in law so that you can't tamper with it when you're down in Fillmore County selling a snow machine. You can't tamper with that right now. So that will help constituents on both sides of the aisle. If there are any questions, Mr. Franz would answer them, but this is a pretty straightforward bill.
What's Representative Schoen, what's the effective date of your legislation?
Got a snowmobile to sell?
I do. I've got a snowmobile with a lot of miles on it. I didn't know it was perfectly legal.
No,
that happy is a sharp fella.
You got me.
There's no effective date.
I assume that it's probably an August 1st default date. That gives me a few months to roll back that odometer before
yes,
this
sir,
takes
Mr. Chair. We didn't prescribe.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there provisions in the bill to dictate with snowmobiles that may at one time have been tampered with for disclosure?
Either Mr. Franzen or Representative Schoen. Who wants to take that one? Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Sorry, wrong bill.
Okay.
It simply says you cannot do it. What we have found is that we've had several experiences where a dealer, and I'm doing the parentheses, someone basically has a garage or a pole barn, will get a very high mileage snowmobile from the western states around Yellowstone. They've used them as rental for a few years, high miles, turn back, and then sell the snowmobile to an unsuspecting consumer as if it has 3,000 miles as opposed to 30,000 miles on it. All it takes is once under the hood for a mechanic to know that it's not a 3,000 or 30,000 mile wear on that machine. And this ties into the existing motor vehicle law, which prohibits tampering with odometers as well. So it tracks with all the penalties and provisions of that law.
So, Mr. Chair,
just before we go to you, Representative Schultz, for purposes of a clear record, Mr. Franzen, who do you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Franzen. I represent the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association, and we do support this bill.
And so the record is clear. The Atkins family is a member, I believe, of that organization, and the Atkins do not tamper with odometers, even if it is legal through October 1st. Representative Schultz, and then back to Representative Swedzinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski, so the answer would be, if it's allowable for a motor vehicle, then it would be the same here. That this is just adding to those statutes. So if you could replace the dash in your car and you have a disclosure for that, it would be the same for
Sounds good. That's what I want to know.
All right. Representative Swedzinski, that concludes your questions with a thumbs up, no less. Anyone else have questions or concerns? Anyone else desires to be heard with respect to House File 917? Seeing none, Representative Schoen renews his motion that House File 917 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schoen. As long as you're there, Representative Schoen moves House File 2413 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is our sales representative bill. It's a simple and easy to understand bill. It closes a loophole in Minnesota statutes. A Minnesota statute that right now, when a Minnesota company terminates a Minnesota sales representative, they must follow Minnesota law. However, when a non-Minnesota company terminates a Minnesota sales representative, they typically have the choice to follow the law of either their home state or Minnesota law, whichever they decide is their choice. Quite simply, this bill would require out-of-state companies to follow Minnesota law when terminating a Minnesota sales rep. If an individual from another state violates the Minnesota law, that individual is held responsible. Individuals don't have the right to choose which state law is better for them. The same standard would apply to the businesses. And this bill protects small Minnesota sales rep businesses from unfair labor laws that should have no standing in Minnesota. And then also, I don't know if Representative Beard was going to come down and be here as well, too. He's one of the co-authors. He carried this legislation last year. Just in a show of nonpartisan support. So, and I also have a testifier here that would like to say a couple words.
And thank you, Representative Schoen. Before we do the testimony, is the A1 amendment an author's amendment?
Yes, sir.
It's my understanding
yes,
that it is.
Yes,
all right.
Is.
Representative
thank
Schoen
you.
Moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Sir, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gene Hoff. I'm an attorney. I work with Minnesota sales representatives. Primarily when they're terminated in the Twin Cities area, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. But Representative Schoen was right. This closes a loophole, which really hurts Minnesota reps, because each individual state's laws don't necessarily protect representatives from their home state. For example, California has a sales rep bill, but it doesn't apply to Minnesota reps because you're not in California. You don't have California as your territory. So for those, or some of those folks that may have a question, well, what if people negotiate that? They're negotiating nothing, because a lot of states don't have any rights for reps unless you're in their home state. So this just closes a loophole, and it's a good amendment.
Thank you. Are there questions? For Mr. Hoff, or for Representative Schoen. Representative Hoppe. Oh,
Mr. Chair, I have a question for you. Have we killed a Schoen bill yet this year?
Well, this one is technically more of a Beard bill.
All right.
I'll accept that, Mr. Chair.
Well, and Representative Schoen, to your credit, it was very gracious of you to acknowledge that Representative Beard, I believe, has carried this at least once. And I know that he was intending to join us today if he could. But it's a nice acknowledgement that he's put in some serious effort on it as well. So
much so, yeah.
Are there other questions for Representative Schoen or for Mr. Hoff? Is there anyone else that desires to be heard? Seeing none, Representative Schoen renews his motion that House File 2413 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you.
We must have put a Lily bill.
Yeah, I think we should go after Lily. We got two Lily bills in a row. Woo. And I don't know that we've ever...
Well,
I don't know. Yeah, which... I'm guessing Mr. Eager wants it to be the next one, not this one. Representative Lilly, which one do you want to do first? 2695 or 94?
2695, please.
All right. Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly moves that House File 2695 be referred to the General Register. There is an A3 author's amendment. Is that correct, Representative Lilly?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lilly moves the A3 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Lilly, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to be in the real estate business, and they said I was doing great, and they suggested I buy a bunch of stuff, and I have a garage full of these ice scrapers, so if anybody wants ice scrapers, I've had these since the
Everybody who wants can raise your hand, please. Did you bring the box with you?
I didn't bring them, but it's amazing how
I move the bill be tabled until Representative Lilly brings his ice scrapers.
They are in North St. Paul, Mr. Chair and members, but it's pretty funny. They said I was doing great, but I couldn't feed my family, so I don't know.
Well, you got to sell houses, not just buy ice scrapers, apparently.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, House File 2695 that we're bringing before you today is legislation that's brought by the realtors, and then it's supported by the independent insurance agents and brokers, and National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. And Representative David's like this. It's about education, and so that might perk his attention. And we had the amendment. We added that on. But today I have Mr. Eager here with me from the Realtors, and I'm going to pass it to him and let him describe the bill in more detail.
Thank you. Mr. Eager, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Paul Eager, representing the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I'd just like to thank Representative Lilly and our bipartisan group of co-authors, including Representative Davids, for bringing this bill forward. And I'd also like to thank Mr. Spizzetto and his clients, the insurance agents and the financial advisors. Again, I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill, so I'll be very brief. What we're doing in this bill is we're simply expanding or broadening the definition of a classroom course for licensee education to acknowledge the role that technology plays in delivering courses. And so this will allow easier use of simulcast live courses to either a remote setting where there's a proctor that's checking people into the course, or to individual students at home or at work where there's an opportunity for them to authenticate their identity, and also to, if it's a one-hour course, to ensure that they're checking in from time to time through the 1 hour. That's the bill, Mr. Chair, and the amendment represents some feedback we received from the Department of Commerce, and that addresses what they asked us to incorporate.
Thank you, Mr. Eager. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this legislation, this fine piece of legislation, as Representative Davis likes to say? Representative Zellers, you're looking for an ice scraper?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if Representative Lilly would yield for a series of questions on ice scraper technology.
He will.
You know what?
Or maybe not.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Fine piece of legislation, as long as he takes back all the ice scrapers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, it's interesting, as a politician, we get all those flyers in the mail, and in many other states remind me of somewhat of the real estate business, because they have like fingernail files for politicians, and I don't know, it's just a variety of, you know, products. But anyways,
it's one of the best laws that we have that does not allow for that here in Minnesota. So are there any other questions with respect to House File 2695? If not, Representative Lilly renews his motion that House File 2695 be referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. As long as you're there, House House File 2694 is moved by Representative Lilly to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. There's also an author's amendment. Is that right, Representative Lilly, the A3 amendment?
We can do that. That's correct, Mr. Chair. And there's a oral amendment that we'd like to incorporate into the A3, if that'd be possible, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you want to put it?
We'd like to delete page or section 40 on page 22. That section 40 on page 22. Is that correct, Mr. Pender?
Mr. Pender will tell us where he wants to put this. Is on the A3 amendment to House File 2694. And so on that A3 amendment, you want to add a section that deletes section 40. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pender, how would you like to reflect that request?
Mr. Chair, to do it orally, just delete section 40 of House File 2694.
Okay. Why don't we do that, Representative Lilly, why don't we do that as a separate oral amendment, separate from the A3 amendment? So Representative Lilly is moving that section 40 of the bill be deleted. Is there further discussion or anyone who wants to be heard with respect to it? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Section 40 is deleted. Now we will take up the A3 amendment. Representative Lilly moves the A3 amendment, which is an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Lilly, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is also brought by the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and it House File 2694 makes numerous technical changes and clarifies some of the terms and whatnot in Chapter 82 of our wonderful books and laws of the state of Minnesota, which I've seen Representative Atkins study immensely. And
carry him wherever I go.
But again, I have Mr. Egger here to expound some of the details.
Mr. Egger.
Spare you my misery.
Mr. Chairman, again, Paul Egger representing the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And again, we're here in support of this bill. I want to thank Representative Lilly and our co-authors for bringing it forward. And I also want to thank the Department of Commerce for providing some feedback on this. This bill started through a conversation we had with them over the summer, where they indicated they were going to be going through all the chapters that they're responsible for and trying to clean up some language and delete some sections and update various provisions. And so we told them that we would take a shot at doing that for the real estate licensing chapter, which is the bill in front of you right now. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. We took a few sections out that I had received some questions on, and the idea here is not to have a controversial bill or to have things that are raising questions, but to clarify. So we took out some language, and the other part of the author's amendment represents the feedback we received from the department. What we did is, Mr. Chair, we went through every section of the bill, and I'm certainly not going to take your time and go section by section through the bill in front of you. I'll just touch on a few of the highlights of what's contained in the bill. One of the things we try to do is we try to delete some obsolete language and also to add definitions to the definition section for a few terms that are common terms used throughout the chapter, but for whatever reason through the years have never been actually defined in the definition section. We also went through and where there seemed to be terminology that indicated perhaps submitting paper applications or paper copies to the Commissioner of Commerce for various things like license applications. We changed that to be more neutral language that accommodates electronic submissions or else just submitting things in a manner prescribed by the Commissioner. One of the obsolete provisions that we identified for appeal is the sub-agency relationship that's found in Chapter 82. This is a relationship that is that exists in law, but with the more common approach to representing buyers and sellers through either buyer representation, seller representation, or dual agency, we weren't able to find any of our members that actually utilize this type of relationship. So we're repealing that. We also have a section in the bill, Mr. Chairman, that amends the advertising requirements, and I'm not sure why there are such specific requirements related to advertising, but there are in the chapter. And there was some language that talks about that discusses a requirement that a licensee shall identify himself or herself as either a broker or an agent salesperson in any advertising. We simplified that language and changed it to any advertising by a licensee must include the real estate brokerage name more prominently displayed than the licensee name, which is more of the common practice. Just the last item, Mr. Chair, that I'll touch on. In the bill, we do update the earnest money language in the chapter, which predates buyer representation and really doesn't account for the most common situation today when you're buying or selling, or when you're buying a home or making an offer, which is that you write a check and you provide that to your buyer's agent. The buyer's agent generally holds on to that check until the offer is accepted, and then it's transmitted to the listing broker. The language in the chapter is pretty outdated, and we thought it needed to be refreshed, and this doesn't change the way that earnest money is handled, but it simplifies the language and accurately reflects the way transactions work. And with that, Mr. Chair, there are a lot of sections in the bill, but those are the highlights.
Thank you, Mr. Hager, and I think Representative Dean is going to have you go through it section by section. Is that your request, Representative Dean?
Mr. Chair, no, not section by section.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, and I guess this would be to both of you possibly. The sub-agent, you said it's been deleted because it doesn't apply, but the sub-agent also makes, I think, some clarity that oftentimes the realtor is acting on the seller's behalf first. So with the I guess, dual broker or dual agency broker, is there still a hierarchy, or is now that individual representing both the buyer and the seller's interests equally?
Great question. Mr. Hager?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, what we're trying to do here, and I think what we've done, unless the language isn't doing what we intend, is to repeal the sub-agency relationship. And the reason for that is with dual agency, there really isn't, nobody's practicing sub-agency, or brokers aren't even offering that relationship option to buyers and sellers. So it seemed like if it's an outdated and it's not being used, that we should just repeal it off the statutes. So buyers would have the option of having buyer representation or dual agency under current law.
Representative Dean.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I've always loved it when I'm purchasing a home as a buyer and they say, well, the seller's paying for that. Because, quite frankly, as the buyer, you're paying the seller to pay for it. So I just wanted to have that clarification just so I understood it. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions from members or anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 2694? If not, then Representative Lilly will renew his motion that House File 2694 is amended to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And then our final bill up this afternoon is House File 2419, Representative Fritz's bill. She'll move that House File 2419 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. As I think we've apprised members, this bill is going to be taken up for discussion today and testimony from both sides. Then it'll be laid over until we have a chance to revisit it again. Quite frankly, that is mostly because my daughter has a basketball game, and Representative Davids told me never miss. And it's the section semifinals, and so with your gracious understanding, I just made that executive decision with Representative David's consultation. Representative Fritz, to your
Mr.
bill.
Mr. Chair, who are they playing?
Bill Murray.
Oh. We got money on Hill Murray.
You know, it didn't matter who I said, did it?
It really didn't.
And I believe that Representative Lilly represents some of those pioneers over there. So they've split over the course of the season. They're 1-1, so this will be the tiebreaker. But
right.
I appreciate your understanding. And,
Mr. Well, Chair, is the game at 8? We should be fine.
No. Representative Fred Steverville.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you for giving us this opportunity to present to you House File 2419. And Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to present an overview of the bill and hear testimony and then take questions afterwards. Mr. Chair and members, the purpose of House File 2419, the Minnesota Secure Choice Retirement Savings Plan, is very simple: to make it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement. We are facing a crisis of retirement insecurity in our state and country, with nearly 1 million Minnesota workers have no retirement savings options through their employer. And of these, only 6% save for retirement outside of work. As a result, many households nearing retirement age, 55 to 64, have no retirement savings to speak of and face the prospect of living in or near poverty on only Social Security or continuing to work indefinitely into their retirement years. To begin addressing this crisis, the bill studies a series of questions while establishing the infrastructure and systems needed to create a state-managed individual retirement account, or IRA, for workers who have no retirement savings options through their employer. This bill does not open the plan for enrollment. That will require passage of another bill once all of our ducks are in a row and we have answers to the questions posed in this bill. The purpose of creating the Minnesota Secure Choice Savings Plan are numbered in Section 2 of the bill, starting on page 3. In summary, these goals are to promote greater and more stable retirement income for as many people as possible who do not have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan by minimizing barriers to participation, such as inconvenience, minimum opening balances, or sufficient knowledge of or confidence to select investments or manage a portfolio, minimizing fees and providing for portability across employers, and doing this without any state liability or guaranteed level of benefits, because as I said before, this bill is simply about making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement. Back on Subdivision 1, we also do this in such a way as to both ensure that the plan is tax preferred like an IRA and that it is not considered an employee benefit, which is regulated by ERISA, or the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which does not apply to IRAs. The key to achieving these goals is contained in Section 3 of the bill, still on page 3, first on line 24. The plan assets are to be invested by the professionals at the State Board of Investment, who have graciously provided technical support to the drafting of the bill. These are the same professionals who manage the state's pension investments with the advice of an investment advisory council made up largely of representatives from our state's corporate investment community. Second, near the top of page 4, starting on line 8, the investments are pooled so we can get economies of scale to minimize fees and provide access to the private financial products that are cost prohibited for individuals to access, like insurance against loss or group annuities, which can help provide for a more secure and stable stream of retirement income. Finally, Subdivision 3 provides for the plan investment and the administration to be paid for by fees on the investments, as with other retirement plans, making the plan self-sustaining without general fund dollars. And Subdivision 6 ensures that the state is not on the hook for the payment of any benefits, which Subdivision 5 makes clear, and simply the individual participants' account balance when they have become eligible to receive the benefit. Again, this bill is about making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement. In addition to this, pardon me, I lost my spot. For to save their own money for their own retirement. In addition to this infrastructure, the plan needs an administrative body, just as the state pension plans have their own pension boards, to handle the back office administration functions of enrolling participants, managing requests to change contribution amounts, changes of address, etc. Section 5, beginning on page 5, creates this board with 9 members, including the Commissioner of Management and Budget, and 4 others appointed by the governor, including expertise in finance and investing, and an employer and employee representative, plus 2 non-legislators, each appointed by the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader. In Subdivision 6, starting in the middle of page 6, this board is charged with establishing the systems necessary to enroll participants, accept plan contributions, pay benefits, and set the fee structure, including the creation of materials for participants. The board is also charged with studying a series of questions, the first of which is actually back in Section 4 on page 5, on whether there is a way for employers to voluntarily choose to make contributions to the plan on behalf of their employees without coming into conflict with ERISA. However, the rest of these questions are in Section 7, starting near the bottom of page 8, including the state of retirement security in Minnesota, the overall impact of improving retirement security, the specific options for structuring contributions and benefits to best achieve the goals of the plan, the cost of the program to participants and their employers, and statutory changes needed to open the plan to enrollment, as well as implement the board's recommendations. In closing, this bill is about, as I said, making it easier for individuals to save their own money for their own retirement, and simply sets up the infrastructure and systems necessary to create a state-managed IRA for workers who have no retirement savings options through their employer, while studying a series of questions to help best structure the plan without opening the plan for enrollment. So that pretty much sums up all of the bill, Mr. Chairman, and I do have some testifiers, if I could go to them.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Fritz. Who would you like to have testify first?
John? Yes.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is John Fraz, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 2419. Because over a 50-year working life, done a lot of many different types of work, from assistant teaching in a preschool to over-the-road trucking. I've done a lot of temporary seasonal work, agricultural work, tanneries, many different things of that nature, and in all these predominantly low-wage jobs. The only time I briefly had access to a retirement savings plan is in a job where, despite the fact that I could have access to this retirement savings plan, I couldn't continue to earn credit on my Social Security retirement. They were like self-insured or whatever. It was a big school district out west, and so they were not in the Social Security retirement program, and I didn't think that was a real good, you know, choice. I don't think anyone should have to trade off their Social Security to be in a retirement program. So, okay, so after the crash of 08, I was let go from my truck driving job. And after exhausting all my unemployment benefits, still unable to find work, I felt like my only option was to take early Social Security retirement. And because it was early, my benefits were significantly reduced. So, after a lifetime of work, I'm now living below the poverty level, trying to make ends meet at less than $10,000 a year. I find myself needing to access food support, Medicaid, and since 2011, I've been, you know, able to find maybe a day a week of a little bit of extra work. Right now, I'm working 3 or 4 hours a week with a friend of mine who has a small restaurant. And so I guess if I would have been able to conveniently and continuously contribute possibly small amounts to you know, retirement program throughout my working years, and do it in a way that might have been portable. Maybe I could be retired with a little more comfort and dignity, not facing the situation I'm in today. So I'm asking you to consider this option, House File 2419, for today's hardworking families, so they might have something more to look forward to than a poverty level retirement.
Thank you, Mr. Fraz.
Yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Guest. I'm a small business owner, and I own Skylark Dry Cleaning. We're an environmentally friendly dry cleaner. We have a pickup and delivery service that covers the whole metro area, where we have 6,000 customers. We also have partnerships with boutique grocery stores and even barbershops like the Capital Barber next door. My business partners and I started this business 4 years ago. And as an idealistic new business owner, I wanted to help offer health care and a retirement plan for my employees. But unfortunately, reality hit me in the face when we discovered the cost of setting up a retirement plan. Beyond just the cost of that retirement plan, the paperwork that we'd had to fill out for each and every employee was astronomical. And so because of that, we had to set aside that idea to offer a retirement plan. But since that time, I've had a number of employees come approach me to ask if there is a way for them to contribute to a retirement plan. Most recently, Margarita Carrillo, one of the first hires when I started Skylark, approached me. She is in her early 40s, a single mother of a young daughter, and she's trying to look towards to the future and knowing that Social Security probably will not be enough, and that she would like to set aside just a little bit out of each paycheck. And I would like to accommodate her. So I'm hoping that you'll support this legislation to allow small businesses to provide affordable that mechanism for a retirement account for their employees. I think it would help everybody, including my employees.
Thank you, Mr. Guest.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Mary Jo George from AARP. And members, I know folks have questions. We're just going to hold off if it's all right. We'll take all the questions at the end. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George from AARP Minnesota. On behalf of our members, we appreciate the opportunity to testify today and would like to thank Representative Fritz for her leadership in sponsoring this legislation. AARP believes rebuilding the promise of financial security in retirement must include modern, expanded options. As you've heard from Representative Fritz, our nation and its working families face vast retirement savings deficits, estimated to be as much as $6.6 trillion, or about $57,000 per household. We also know that research shows that the typical working age household only has $3,000 in retirement assets, while near retirement households only have $12,000 saved. Unfortunately, this is not enough. The statistics for our seniors don't hold much better. Currently, one in seven seniors in Minnesota lives in poverty, and over half of these are elderly women. Three out of five families headed by a person 65 or older have no money in retirement savings. And 28% of Minnesota residents 65 and over rely on Social Security for their only income. As this committee knows, Social Security was never supposed to be the sole source of income for retirees, but as we've seen a decline in employer-sponsored retirement plans, we do think it's important to eliminate the barriers to retirement planning, and the Minnesota Secure Choice Plan does that. We believe this plan makes it convenient because people can save on the job and they can continue to save when they switch jobs, so it's portable. The plan would be voluntary and available to private sector workers who don't currently have retirement savings on their job at their work place of work. In addition, by pooling the participants' contributions, the plan could achieve economies of scale and help to negotiate lower fees for participants. Minnesota is not alone in considering a state-facilitated retirement plan. AARP has been working across the country in nearly a dozen state legislatures considering different models of retirement plans. It's clear that workers are not prepared for retirement, but by helping people plan for self-sufficiency, the state can ultimately win by reducing our safety net spending. And the good news we know is that people choose to save when offered the opportunity at work to save. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. George. I also, next up, I have Robin Roan and Roger Grumdahl from MFSE and Thrivent, respectively.
Yeah, Robin, here, I'll get up and you sit down.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm going to go first because I'm like that. Okay, we're organized. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Service Council, known as MFSE. MFSE members offer life insurance, annuities, long-term care insurance, and long-term retirement savings products to Minnesotans. And we have 75,000 jobs in this state, including the agents and financial advisors that help Minnesotans plan for secure retirement all across the state, all of whom would be more than happy to have anyone to help anyone who doesn't think they have access to a retirement plan. Minnesotans absolutely need to save more for retirement. We couldn't agree more with that. And incenting small employers to offer workplace retirement plans is a crucial part of achieving that goal. But we do not agree that setting up the state in the private retirement business at great expense to taxpayers and to small businesses is the answer. The proponents cite a lack of affordable and accessible options as a reason for the state to get involved in the private retirement business. There are many reasons why employers may not offer retirement plans: health care costs, a challenging economy, lack of employee interest, and quite frankly, a lot of people don't even have the money to save. But a lack of easy to administer and affordable plans is simply not one of them. For example, employers can offer simple IRAs for as little as $15 per year per account. When I spoke with some of the proponents of this bill, they seem to think that financial firms don't want middle-income or lower-income money. We do. Let me get rid of any misunderstanding. We want everybody's money. There's simply no evidence that the state-run plan can offer more affordable options, especially without the economies of scale that the private sector firms have, with billions of dollars of assets under management and millions of consumers. In addition, the setup costs could be staggering. Government estimates in California of setting up a system that could accept payroll deductions from multiple employers with multiple systems run between $15 and $25 million. And then there's the issue of staffing. A lot of these people are going to be first-time investors, and who's going to help them answer basic questions? I mean, if you are a lower-income worker, I mean, should you be putting money in an IRA where the money isn't liquid and you can't get to it? I mean, these are questions that the state is going to have to help people understand. All of this makes it even less likely that the fees charged to people are going to be able to compete with the private market, which offer very, very low competitive products. And the elephant in the room is ERISA, which governs all private retirement plans. The bill says that the plan must not be found to be an ERISA plan, but I don't think you can preempt federal law that way. Employment lawyers and analogous Department of Labor opinions, U.S. Department of Labor opinions, indicate that the requirements, costs, and protections under ERISA would likely apply, and the state would be a fiduciary, which means they're liable for losses suffered and for any misconduct and mismanagement. I think, from what I understand from other committees, that the proponents believe that because they're offering IRAs, individual accounts, that somehow that gets around or that there's a safe harbor from ERISA, but it's not. The state is pooling retirement resources and has discretion and manages the plan. There's no way around ERISA that way. Participation would also likely make the small employers who are part of the plan also be subject to ERISA, which greatly increases the expense of participating in these plans. I mean, if I don't know how familiar people are with the ERISA requirements, but they require a lot of reporting and disclosure. And the summary of just the reporting and disclosure requirements is an 8-page booklet. And that's just the summary of what you have to do to comply with the reporting and the disclosure. But I think a bigger question is also, if for some reason ERISA didn't apply, then what protections are there for consumers who invest in these plans? I mean, ERISA is there to protect people's retirement assets from mismanagement. And without ERISA, I'm not sure what protections are here. The bill says the state isn't liable for any losses, so I'm not really sure how all that fits together, but it's troubling. Finally, no state that has considered this has set up a state-run plan for private employees. California is currently conducting a $1 million study and has to determine before going forward, one, that the plan could actually be self-sustaining, it would not have to be subsidized by taxpayer dollars, two, that it would not be an ERISA plan, and three, that it would the plans would actually receive favorable treatment from the IRS. I usually don't point to California as a model of prudence and caution, but I mean, don't you think we should answer these threshold questions before moving forward and getting the state into the retirement business and taking care of our citizens' savings? I think this is a very unusual study bill in that it's a study that predisposes an outcome and then basically asks for a progress report. And we think there should be a wide-ranging study that looks at whether this is feasible even. And there are also other issues, things that the state can do that actually would help people save more for retirement. Financial literacy is a big deal. Also, people need an education about how to invest. And we can all examine ways to get small employers, to incent small employers to be able to offer plans to their employees. And we do not think this bill is the answer to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roan. Ms. Crumdell.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members and others. My name is Roger Grumdahl. I'm a 22-year veteran with Thrivent Financial here in the Twin Cities. I work with all levels of clients. I represent also NAFA, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. We have about 1,500 members across the state and 15 locals. We meet once a month and do education, ethics training, and other programs throughout the state. In addition to the 1,500 that are members, there's over 40,000 people in Minnesota that work directly in the insurance and finance industry, as you know. And I was asked to tell a little bit about my typical day on the job, and I think that's helpful. So I want to share that with you and then take any questions. My typical day is one where I try to connect with individuals, small business owners, family members, single moms, people from all spectrums of the economy in the state, in my area, and try to connect with them in a way that says, how can I be of service to you with your financial concerns? And that connection comes in about three different ways. It's very straightforward. One, it's a referral. Being around this long, surviving the wars in our industry and so on, I get a lot of referral. Secondly, I do a lot of workshops, educational workshops, where there's no implication or suggestion that a person has to sign up for anything or pay anything. We even feed them, and we give them great information. If they want to work with us, they can do so after that meeting. And so we do those weekly workshops at least once a week for people, and we invite as many people as can come. We're now even getting into email invitations, which is helping too. And then the third way is social networking. So any of you in the room here that would like to meet with me, including the person with the dry cleaner, I'd love to work with you and explain to you how we can get you a program that's affordable, because there are some really inexpensive ways. I'm familiar with the kind of things you face.
Hey, we got Representative David sells the same stuff. If you're going to make a sales pitch down
here,
to
Mr.
Chairman, I was going to contact the gentleman.
When you're a sales rep, it's part of your life.
You just can't help it.
See, no access problem.
So there's no real access problem. The other thing I'd like to share with you is that when I meet a new client, a new person, and they're open to the idea of talking with me, I often recall for them my story when I was in graduate school, and I had no money, and I thought I should know all this stuff. And it took the rep a year to get through to me to say, Raj, you only need $50 a month to make something happen. And my wife gave me that look that only wives can give husbands, said, sign the paper. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. because a rep was patient with me and educated me, even though I had a business degree and was in graduate school, about finance and how to do personal finance and take charge of my money, and so our money. And so I share that story with all my clients. You know, it's not really so much about what the balance sheet is when the person comes in. It's what they want to do from here forward, no matter where they are in life. We all know that. We can change our habits. We can learn to learn and grow in our life, and that's really what financial advisors like I try to do. It's both education, motivation, and tracking. Those are the three key elements. Every client I have, regardless of the size of their plan, gets personal attention from me. They have my cell phone 24/7, 365. I don't get many calls in the middle of the night or on the weekend. I have had a few. Not from Mr. David.
Sold at five.
Just got the sale from David.
All right. They receive my personal attention, but beyond that, we have an extremely excellent hotline to our home office that's open extended hours. We have web access, email access. People have access to us for questions, simple or complex, all the time, anytime. And you know, the thing about it is that this is also accompanied by at least an annual review. Even if your balance is $500, you're going to get a call from me or my staff. Let's talk about what's going on, what's happening with your life. We look for ways for clients to get the least expensive plan for their situation with the most benefit. We take into account through very sophisticated but simple questions on there, nine questions on a questionnaire to help them understand their risk tolerance. We look at their time horizon. Are they 60 years old? Are they 40 years old? Are they 30 years old? Where are they at in that time horizon thing? What are the needs for income? And we do that in a way that's consumer friendly. We talk to them about their dreams and their goals and what a retirement plan or other investments could mean for them and for their family. We treat our clients with respect and clarity, and we make sure that they're heard, and we provide exceptional service. In this process has been going on in our industry for over 100 years, very systematically. And I work for an old firm here, as you know, in the Twin Cities headquartered, where we're 110 years old. And this program, this process that we use is no different than it was 110 years ago. It's sitting down with people who are serious about taking charge of their money, regardless of where they are on the spectrum, and helping them move forward in a small steps, baby steps at first, and then later in a big way. And I've watched clients, I've seen clients move from near poverty or poverty level to a level of sustainability and great wealth. I could tell stories, I don't want to bore you with those. I know it's late. The bottom line for me is I'm not the only one rep, or our company is not the only company that uses this process and that cares about Minnesotans and has a heart like you have as legislators for the people of Minnesota. We have a great group of people across this state that work diligently and are open, have their doors open, their phone lines open for anybody that wants help, even if it means there's no sale, even if it means there's no profit, because we know if we do the right thing, the right things will happen down the road for us, and that's our attitude. So I want to share just kind of that motivation with you, that idea. And by the way, you can start an IRA with our firm for $50 a month and no charge up front. So you don't need a lot of money. And you can do that through payroll deduction with our firm, okay, electronically every 2 weeks, $25 every 2 weeks. And it's that simple. And other people in our industry do the same thing. This is not an industry designed just for the elite. It's for everyone, and if there's a problem, we have a problem with education and letting people know that they can approach an agent. They can go to Cub Foods and go to the TCF Bank and open an IRA. They don't need the state of Minnesota to do it for them. So that's my attitude on that.
And Mr. Grumdahl, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've got two final people on the agenda. I'm trying to keep the that's Bill Straczynski and Mr. Hickey from NFIB. There's probably others that want to testify in terms of the list, so I've got Mr. Straczynski and Mr. Hickey. As far as opponents and proponents, Mr. Straczynski, you've got about 11 seconds, so feel free to really wind up and let her. We'll do our best to just balance it out. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. We laud what Representative Fritz is trying to accomplish, but there are other ways that may be more practical, and certainly I want to share with you some things that exist that nobody seems to know anything about that I've just been bringing forward this past week. I thought it was of very much interest that the proponents of the bill basically talk about a state-managed IRA. They were looking for pooling, and they're looking for the ability to negotiate lower fees. On January 29th, President Barack Obama in his State of the Union address talked about MIRA. Now, MIRA is a new concept, and he talked about it, and he issued an executive order the next day to create the MIRA. And MIRAs really will be offered through employers. It's a Roth sort of IRA. It's branded as a Roth IRA by the IRS. And in his executive order, he set up the mechanism to do that. I think it's really interesting. I have the RFP for the MIRA federal plan, which just came out on February 27th. It's 13 pages long. It's a national program, and the responses are to be back March 31st. This program, this federal program, will be available this year. And the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association supports that program. Let me just share with you and endorses that program. A couple of quick things about the MIRA. Minimum fee, dollar thresholds. The minimum initial investment is $25. $5 minimum for contributions thereafter. Tax treatment is treated, it's deductible like a Roth IRA.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, a Roth IRA is not deductible.
Mr. Straczynski, if you can, and as much as you know, we're fans of other. If you can just, I just want to make sure we balance the time. So what we get your point though is that the MIRA will be available shortly.
Well, tax treatment is governed by the tax, like the IRA. I'm reading from the RFP, Mr. Chairman. And the other thing is that I think it's important is your investment will never go down. It'll always be maintained because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, so you can't lose money.
Reassuring.
And there are no fees for a customer or for the employer for this program. And you can do it at $5, $5 per payroll. After $15,000, which earning interest after 30 years, you can transfer that portably. You can transfer it to any retirement fund. So I've talked to Representative Fritz about that. There are certainly options that are now available that probably weren't when this bill certainly was probably drafted. But things will be, there's opportunities there. And thank you for the time.
And thank you. Mr. Hickey, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey, National Federation of Independent Business. We represent 13,000 small businesses across the state, as many as you know. I went to a very confusing Senate hearing yesterday, and maybe we'll achieve better clarity here today, but it certainly looks like an implementation plan we're talking about here and not a study. And it's an implementation plan with a decision that's already made ahead of time. And so I think that's important to know. And it's certainly not a study, and we feel this should be studied and should not be doing an implementation plan. Our biggest concern, I want to echo some of the concerns of some of the other people in a minute, but our biggest concern is where are the obligations going to be on already burdened small employers? If you have one employee who wants to participate, does that trigger mandatory involvement by the company? Do you have to do withholding? Do you have to do reports? It's really unclear to me after sitting through that hearing yesterday, what are the actual obligations on small employers? And we hear a lot about administrative burden and trying to deal with governmental regulations on NFIB's problem and priorities. National survey dealing with government regulations is the fifth biggest problem, the small business, on the recent survey. And so we're very concerned about where does this go for employers, what's their obligations, are there penalties, are there annual reports required, all triggered by possibly just one employee choosing to participate in this. And it's also been instructional to go to these hearings just to hear what we heard. You could start an IRA with as little as $50, and all the investment options that are out there at very low dollar levels. And I think the private sector in our state and our country is offering so much, not to mention what President Obama is offering with a guarantee, if that's actually possible. The way this country is moving debt-wise, but apparently they're trying to say that. But anyways, we're just very concerned about where this is going and what are the real obligations on employers, and thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Ms. Cadoon? I got and then we'll ask if there's any others. I just saw you line up there and wanted to be welcome back.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. I am here in opposition to House File 2078. We're certainly supportive of the goal, which is to increase savings. However, we do not believe creating a state-run retirement plan is the solution. A state-run retirement plan, we believe, will add costs to the taxpayer as well as potential future liabilities for taxpayers. And we also believe there's ample private sector options available, as was mentioned by the previous testimony, at many at very low cost as well. This is more than a study. The language certainly does say this is setting up the infrastructure. The report is how you implement it, not if you're going to do this. We think the really first steps you should do is first determine if a state should set up a state-run plan that will compete with the private sector. Second, should determine if this plan will increase savings, if this is the ultimate goal. And third, then determine what the cost to the taxpayer is and do that cost-benefit analysis first. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that I was just reading off folks that had pre-filed that they wanted to testify? Is there anyone else who wants to testify? Otherwise, we do have a couple members with questions. Representative Davids?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What time is the ball game?
It starts at 6. So you have.
Well,
about
I want you to get
questions.
Your ball game. I learned that one the hard way. But I've got 83 questions that I'd like to go
next
through.
Next up is Representative Hoppe. Representative
thank
Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got 94 questions.
Okay.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things here. First of all, I have great concerns when we have financial products that are not overseen by the Department of Commerce. Whether it be MNsure, one of my arguments on the floor and in committee was the Department of Commerce has to oversee this. I do not see in this bill where that's the case. A couple of things, the fine gentleman, the first gentleman that testified that was making $10,000, he would have no need for an IRA. He could do a non-qualified plan, Mr. John Fraze. At $10,000, there'd be no reason to have an IRA. In fact, a licensed insurance agent in the state, if they sold an IRA to someone that made $10,000 a year, they would lose their license for malpractice. And so this doesn't help John at all. Now, do we really believe for a second that there's going to be less paperwork by a state-run company versus the private sector company? I can just take the health insurance arena. I can write a health plan through Blue Cross Blue Shield on 3 pages. How many does it take to go through the state plan? Now, another issue here that I have several questions. One is, as the person who brings the money in, is that person licensed by the Department of Commerce? Since they're going into securities in the state investment pool, do you have your Series 6 and 63 licenses? Do you have your Series 7 license? Who's advising the people? Now, the one issue here is that you have one choice. There's no choice in this thing, because choice means you have A or B. Here you have A. There is no choice. It goes into the stock market. If there's one thing you learn, you do not put low-income people into the stock market unless you feel like sitting in jail for a while, and you should if you do that to someone. So we're taking someone's money, putting it in the stock market. So this is called the Minnesota Secure Choice Retirement Savings Board. I call it Invest in the Wall Street Casino, and hold on to your wallet, because you could lose everything. You could lose everything. So there's one option. There's no choices. Now, to the bill, I call this the magic bill, because we're going to do things here by magic. If you go to page 3 and you look at line 3.5, the plan established, and you go down there and it says favorable federal tax treatment ordinarily accorded to IRAs, I don't think that's a problem. I think they would receive that from the IRS. And that must not be determined to be an employee benefit plan under ERISA. Magic. You have an employee benefit, but it's not going to be covered by ERISA. And then go down a little further on line 3.16, providing for stable income through retirement while incurring no liability to the state. More magic. This bill is like me going to write a bill saying I want to weigh 195 pounds and have the good looks of the chairman. It's magic.
Can I sign up for that?
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Pretty dark magic if you want to look like me.
So if we go to fees, the gentleman from Thrivent mentioned it. And in his full disclosure, this is my business.
Are you actually asking a question?
I write plans. Yeah, no, ask me to repeat it. And I,
I was going to, but you're just laying a base here.
Laying a base, all laying right. a foundation. I can go $50 a month for someone with no fees, no fees, no loads, no loads and no fees. Here, we're going to take the lower income folks, throw them in the Wall Street casino, and oh, by the way, we're going to charge you a fee to do it. What could possibly go wrong? If you look at page 5, line 5.18, and this would be a question for the author, when it says a rollover, it says upon the occurrence of a condition permitting a distribution of benefits under the code, the plan participant or beneficiary may elect to roll over the account balance to his or her 401A. Now, my first question is that going to be is the 401A going to be defined benefit or defined contribution? And then it says, for the purpose of attaining a secure retirement income or annuitization. So is this plan going to have annuities, or are we rolling it out of the plan? And then does it have to be a variable, or can it be fixed? So the first question is the 401A, is that a defined benefit or defined contribution?
Who wants to take that?
To the author of the bill.
Defined benefit.
No.
Actually. No. It's a defined contribution. It's
correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Sir, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Brian Elliott. I'm the Executive Director of the Service Employees International Union, Minnesota State Council. On page 1, lines 9 through 12, this is specifically the 401A plan is defined as the under the profit sharing provisions of 401A. Not as a defined benefit pension.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Representative Fritz, on line 5.21, what is a secure retirement income? What is that?
Either Representative Fritz or Mr. Elliott is a proponent of the bill. Mr. Elliott.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. The Again, the goals of the plan in Section 2 on page 3, the intent, as I said, as the bill says, is to provide as stable retirement income as possible. I believe we spoke about this, and one of the ideas that is being studied in Section 7 of the bill is the possibility of annuitization of the resources in order to provide a stable retirement income.
Representative David?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 7, this is probably the most frightening part of the bill, because it says explore and establish investment policies that offer employees returns on contributions of the conversion of an individual plan account balance to a secure retirement income organization. So the way I read that is that you could have a plan with Allianz, American Express, Thrivent, any of the companies that do this every day and very well, I might add. You could, the way it looks to me is you could take an IRA account, a simple, a SEP, a KEO, a 403B, a 401A, a 401K, and you could move it from an existing company into the state plan, into the stock market.
Mr. Elliott.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Could the member please redirect me to which lines he was referring to? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 7.14 through 7.16.
It says
the conversion of the individual plan account balances to secure retirement income or annuitization. So it looks to me like you could take a contract from Allianz, American Express, or Thrivent, or good companies like American Equity or State Farm or Farm Bureau, and you could move that over into the Wall Street casino run by the state.
Mr. Elliott?
Mr. Chair, members, the intent of the bill, and as I speak with the author, we'd be happy to clarify that is not to accept rollovers into the state-run plan. The intent of this section, specifically 7.14 through 7.16, is to determine how to provide secure retirement income through the various private insurance options that are available on the market right now. In other words, as someone achieves retirement age, that would be set by this bill. This is actually determined by the federal statutes governing IRAs. the intent is to explore the options for how their assets could be rolled into from this plan out into private insurance products that would be able to provide a stable retirement income as they achieve that age.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the gentleman,
are you able to ask one more question? Then we've got other members on the list, and I know you've got
several. And you got a ball game, and that's more important than this. Yes, seriously, the ball game is a lot more important than this thing. I'll try to wrap up one question, then I've got 73 more for the floor. Okay, so the people that are going to be receiving the money, it's a couple part question here. Are they going to have background checks so we don't have the possibility of felons taking people's money? And then where's the Attorney General's office on the suitability of the nudization part? Because there's been a big to-do. Companies been sued, fined millions of dollars by Attorney General, hundreds of jobs lost on suitability. So it's a very, very sensitive issue to me and many others. So on the suitability end, first of all, are there background checks so we don't have felons bring the money in, number one? Number two, where is the Attorney General's office, and this may be for a later date, Mr. Chairman, but where is the Attorney General's office on the suitability? Because I have companies where you have to have $75,000 before you can buy a contract list. I have others where it's, I have plenty of access for everybody, because Ms. Rowan was absolutely correct. We want everybody's money, and we want as much of it as we can possibly have.
Mr. Elliott?
So that's true. So where are we on the suitability that we have a suitable sale? Because certainly if you have someone making $10,000 a year, an IRA is not only unsuitable, but I think it would be unethical and illegal to take someone's money for an IRA if they have that. So where are we on the suitability with the AG's office?
Mr. Elliott?
And Mr. Chair, again, Brian Elliott for the record. Members, to answer that in two parts. One, I think we all value your expertise in this area, and if there are additions we can make to this bill to improve any of these pieces, I'd be happy to talk with you about them, and I think we began talking about some of them earlier. The second piece that I want to be very clear about is that this bill does not open the plan for enrollment. The intent is to establish the basic infrastructure, and I think we've been very clear about that piece of the bill that, in fact, it isn't intended to be exclusively a study bill. We intend to establish the basic infrastructure, answer the questions that are necessary prior to opening this plan to enrollment, and I think that the questions you are raising are important questions that need to be answered as part of the study.
So, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Elliott, on that point, though, if you little chair's prerogative, Representative Hoppe, if it's all right, if folks are not afforded the protections under ERISA, and the state with whom they are investing this money does not have any liability, then if something goes wrong, if there's negligence, if there is somebody placed in an unsuitable product, where do they look?
Mr. Chair, the bill asks the board that is established in this bill to recommend. I'm looking for the section. I believe it is in section 7, at the end of section 7. Sorry, end of section 8. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find it very quickly.
But that's at the essence of it, is where do they turn if something goes wrong?
I can't find the reference right now. I can get that for you. But the board is charged with recommending whatever penalties and enforcement mechanisms would be necessary to protect against fraud and other issues.
Okay.
And other issues.
Okay. And in fairness, I mean, we do have certain, right in statute as we stand behind me here, we've got laws on the books that protect people against fraud. I'm just wondering if, in terms of civil liability, and issues like suitability and others. But I interrupted a stream. The next up on the list was Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like Representative Davids, I have a bunch of questions. But in the interest of time, and I know you need to get going, and Representative Fritz, we all like you. And I think it's fairly clear at this point, this bill is very well-intentioned, and we all want people to save more, but I think everybody gets that it's really not necessary. We've heard you know, countless examples of people that are already in the private market that can do this right now for either no entry fee or a very nominal fee for as little as $50 a month. There are other, I know I've heard from other people that have online and other options today that can already do this. So I would encourage you to give some long, hard thought to when we come back as to whether or not you want this to come back. I think, and Mr. Elliott, I know you talked about your goals. I don't think this is necessary, and I think, if anything, I mean, there are a lot of other unanswered questions or a lot of potential problems. I think, if anything, this might incent private employers to drop their insurance plan and dump them all into this plan. And I don't think that's in the best interest of Minnesota workers or savers. I think it's clear that this is not ready for prime time. And, Mr. Chair, I know we're going to lay it over, but just in case I'm hit by a bus or forget, I'd like to ask for a roll call if it does come back.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And actually, to that fundamental question, you did hear some testimony. I just wanted to give you a chance before we adjourned that there's products that are available in the market for as little as $50. I actually pulled up online today. You could go on Vanguard, which I don't think is represented in the room. I tried to pick one that wasn't. Maybe they are, but you can start an account for $50. And I think the fees were like 0.19% or something if you just put it in a basic index fund. Just in real simple terms, why would this be better than that option?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank all of you for your questions. And actually, you know, I've had 80-some questions, too. So your questions, you know, I've given this a great deal of thought, and I know that this is a big proposal. However, I do know that having served here for a number of years, you know, it's a process. And so, and this is a really a crisis. When I know, and you all know, in your towns, in your districts, that many women age out in poverty, and end up in poverty. In my life, in the nursing home field that you all know that I worked in, they come into the nursing home broke, and then they go on the dole for years, and we pay for that. So, and we can't afford that. We cannot afford that. So, I'm looking for solutions. And so that's why I'm here with this bill. It's a good idea brought to me by good people who care about those people that we all care about and represent. And that's the purpose of our meeting this evening. And I take all of the questions and all of the information from all of the people in, and we'll look at it all. And I thank you all for
I appreciate
your honesty.
That. And I think most, I'd be shocked if any member disagreed with the goal, which is to help people or goad people into saving more for their retirement. We heard the story from the first testifier about the tough situation that he's finding himself in, and that was very compelling. Got a couple other members, and then we're going to call it a day. I believe Representative Anderson and then Representative Swedzinski. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fritz. I'm assuming at some point we'll get to see a fiscal note on this, since you have the State Board of Investment doing this. A couple of issues of concern for me is that currently the State Board of Investment manages several different pension funds, and as you know, we recently had to bail out those pension funds, and we as a state have about over $17 billion in unfunded liabilities when it comes to pension funds. So I don't necessarily see us as being a stellar management right now of those funds, and I'm just curious I assume that these folks' retirement dollars have the potential, are they going to be then added into the whole pension fund pool, and how does that work, and if you can kind of speak to that a little bit.
Representative Anderson, no, they will not be into the pension pool. And I did speak with those folks today who have invested, and I think there's someone here from that, yes, that could come down. If there's time, there probably isn't.
But well,
could speak to that that piece if you want them to.
Madam or Mr.
Well,
Chair,
I think we're going to revisit this at some point. Representative Anderson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to meet with them offline if we could. But just to kind of get to my other questions that I had, given the fact that then these folks are going to be part of the State Board of Investment, they're going to be investing their dollars, are these folks then going to be deemed as state employees?
No.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson,
and Representative Fritz, then if they're not deemed state employees, though, is there somebody that's going to be bargaining on their behalf for what their return rate? Because as I know, Mr. Elliott, you had mentioned that you said it was going to be defined contribution, but then upon further commentary from Representative Davids, it's really actually going to be a defined benefit plan with the amounts being secured. So can you tell me, Representative Fritz, you know, what are these folks then having somebody that's going to be bargaining on their behalf, or how does that work? And, you know, how much are they going to be, are there dues, union dues then that will be pulled from their contribution for their retirement? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, as I understand it, no, they will not be paying dues, and they will not have, they will not be part of an organization or union. But I will defer to Brian if he wants to add to that. Any more information that you would have,
Mr.
Okay. Representative Anderson, last question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Elliott, is it the intention then of the SEIU to lobby these individuals then to become part of a union to then negotiate their retirement account? I mean, what's the stake of SEIU into this whole deal?
Mr. Elliott,
Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, for the record, no. We are not intending to organize these individuals. We don't believe that they are state employees or anything to that nature. What we know is that we have a great deal of members who work second jobs, who have no ability through their second jobs to save for retirement. And we also know that representing a lot of workers, as we did Representative Fritz, who work in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, that the issue of retirement security for all Minnesotans is a very important issue, and that is our interest in working on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Swedzinski, with our very last question, making it clear.
I feel bad just going into this because we've got short time here, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of on a quick note, just looking at liquidity, we just heard a bill last week talking about pay loans and access to capital and short-term. You know, when we're looking at folks that are, you know, earning or have very little income coming in, when it looks at, you know, their volatility when it comes to expenses and expenditures, when we're pushing money into an IRA, which is not a very liquid asset, will there be instances where you can take loans out against it like you do in some other forms of retirement plans, or will you be able to have access in any way to it? And then also have a question about the board, but we'll just not take that one up.
The first one's a great question. Mr. Elliott?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I have a very quick answer to your first question, which is the rules that govern under 408A and 408B of the federal code that govern IRAs would govern this plan. And so the same policies that apply to needing to borrow against the plan or withdraw from the plan would be the same policies that apply to all IRAs.
Which you cannot borrow. Representative Swedzinski, which means essentially no,
mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, Representative Swedzinski.
And then, you know, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a note, if for some reason this bill moves forward, I would just ask that I think the best savings account initially is something that's liquid. And if you're going to encourage people to go into an IRA, which is an illiquid, not very movable asset, that you would have minimum savings accounts to adjust for those expenses. So if you're going to make it a plan to put money away, that you would put $10,000 or $5,000 into some sort of an account, savings account, long-term savings account, that it could be a little more liquid before you start socking money away into this where you may not have access to the funds. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski. Thank you to everyone who came and spent some time testifying with respect to the bill. Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chair, good luck tonight.
And thank you, Representative Hoppe. Go Simley. All right, with that, we stand adjourned.